In the episode, it was like a couple weeks ago, one of the characters, Beth, is like, oh, you know, pretty soon Bozeman's going to have a Costco. And this, I'm like, and I texted my friend, we already have a fucking Costco.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Human Reaction. We're glad to have you with us. Wherever you are, please like, subscribe, and follow the channel on your podcast platform of choice. And if you would like to get access to our members-only content, go to humanreactionpod.com to find out how.
And also join our community Discord. I put a bunch of questions forward in the Discord for people to ask our guests today, and I'll be weaving those in as necessary. So go in there. You can chat with us, post dank memes, do all the things.
Yeah, and today we're talking with Dan Bruner, U.S. Navy veteran of 9 years, FBI for 20 years, specializing in South American cartels and RICO cases. And welcome on the podcast,
man. Thank you very much, guys. I appreciate it.
If you are a small business owner looking for exponential growth, you have to connect with Adam Thune at Intellectual Patriots. He will revolutionize your business game and help you get to the next level. Adam can streamline your business practices and advertising strategies to improve your bottom line. His expertise in data engineering means he can build you the systems you need to collect and analyze market data. His mission is to provide you with invaluable insights to fuel your success. From grant writing and business proposals to digital systems integrations, even AI management, Intellectual Patriots is a one-stop shop for cutting-edge solutions. Don't wait another second. Visit intelpatriots.com to learn more. That's intelpatriots.com. This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at RevvedUpPromo.com. That's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link. There's so much we want to talk about. We've been watching a lot of your appearances, and there's like so much in the news these days that feels like it's right up your alley. Mm-hmm. And obviously you've been making, you know, news appearances yourself, kind of trying to express your expertise on these issues that are going on. We got UAPs, we got cyber attacks from China, we got this manhunt for the guy who shot the CEO of United Health. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot to get into. But before we do, maybe let's just get a quick little bit of your background and kind of tell us your story, what you've done and what you're doing today.
Sure, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me, guys. So I was 9 years, grew up in upstate New York. My parents are immigrants here to the country. My mom's from Chile. My dad's from Argentina, but they immigrated here back in 65, I think, 65, something like that. Born and raised upstate New York and then moved to Connecticut and then did a couple years of school at Syracuse. And then Syracuse said, yeah, it's time for you to go. And then I joined the military to straighten things out. Was in the Navy for 9 years. I was in Jacksonville, Florida. It was what's called an operations specialist. So if people don't know, you have the movies, you have a dark room and the big radar scopes. That's what I did. So I was on the ship for 5 years and then did stationed at the Naval Academy for 3 years. Go Navy, beat Army, coming up here next week.
Nice.
So I was at the Naval Academy for 3 years, and then right post 9/11, they were recruiting heavily. So I was at the Naval Academy during 9/11 and the FBI was recruiting heavily. I had just gotten my bachelor's degree. So I was considering what my options were going to be after the Navy, or if I was just going to reenlist and do 20. Because I was already nine in. I was already halfway there towards the pension. But, you know, I'd had some other members in the military in senior chiefs say to me, you know, get out and give it a shot. So a recruiter, an FBI recruiter, was coming to the academy looking for new recruits. Post 9/11, they were really just pumping them through. New agents, 50 new agents every 2 weeks. So one of the things that they were looking for, I traditionally have thought, okay, CPAs and lawyers, that's what every FBI agent is. But they were looking for a lot of different things. And one of them was his language. I am Spanish by descent, obviously, and Spanish is my first language. I spoke that first in my home, and that's all I speak. I still speak Spanish to my mom, but you speak to my mom. My dad's passed away. But if you wouldn't even know that I'm Spanish, and you wouldn't even know my mom is Spanish. But it's my first language. So they said that that was one of the languages they were looking for. So I said, let's give it a shot. So I raised my hand, I took the test, and then 1 year, you know, from September 11th, 2002, I took the phase one exam. And then 1 year later, September 7th, 2003, I was at the FBI Academy. Did 17 weeks at the FBI Academy training. Got my orders to Newark, New Jersey. Reported to Newark, which was my family. All my family's up there in Connecticut. Got stationed in Newark as my first office as a street agent. Worked counterterrorism for 8 years. Four of those years were international terrorism. And then 4 years were domestic terrorism, going after skinheads, white supremacists. And then...
David.
Uh-oh. Hey, he's bald too.
Exactly. We fit in. We'll fit in.
Some
we'll
of it's just a choice. Some of it's genetics, all right?
So I went 4 years, my partner and I, it was at New Jersey, state of New Jersey, he and I partnered up working in the white supremacy, did a couple of years online undercover, but then finally was able to work my way over to the gang unit, and where I showed up, and then they said, here, there's this gang called MS-13. Do you want to do it? Like, sure. And then nobody else wanted to do it. Everyone was busy with gangs, Bloods, and the OCDF, the drug squads. And people weren't too keen on working Hispanic gang, especially there's not a lot of agents that spoke Spanish. There's very, very few in Newark, surprisingly. So I picked it up, and then I never left. So I spent 20 years as a street agent. I never took a supervisory job. Enjoyed it and loved every second of it. Let me correct myself. I didn't love every second of it. There was good times, there was bad times, just like any other job.
Right.
But I wouldn't trade it for the world. Mm. I loved it. And, spent a lot of time doing different cases, doing, you know, different investigations there in New Jersey, Mexico, El Salvador, all around the world, Spain, lots of different cases around the world. And then when it was time to retire, my wife and I decided, 2023 was good, because that's 20 years. You have to be 20 years in the Bureau and 50 years old. You have to meet those two markers, and then you can retire. Mm. I had my military time. They gave me 29 years federal service. I said, I'm out. And then my wife and I started our company up here, Bruner Sierra Group, up here in Bozeman. And, never turned back. Mm. So loving it in life.
And what's the company? What's Bruner Sierra Group?
So it's really, my wife is the brains of the operation. Now let's joke around here. So Christine and I started the Bruner Sierra Group, which is just the two of us. But what we do is, so she's a forensic accountant. So she never was an agent. She never was law enforcement. So she worked in Manhattan, New York City, Manhattan. For those who are not from Montana, there's a Manhattan right down the road from here. So we have to say that. I worked in Manhattan, New York City, Manhattan.
Not Kansas either.
Not Kansas, right. So she worked in Manhattan for a high net worth value family for 16 years and total in 23 years in New York City. So she's brilliant beyond our means. And when she, during COVID, we got our master's degrees. We just sat down on our laptops because our kids were 2 years old. So they were, kind of manageable. So we worked on she got her master's degree in accountancy. So she's a forensic accountant. So she got her CPA at the same time as her master's degree. So now she's a forensic accountant with a CPA. So what she does is she goes and she works for attorneys who need her to figure out where the money went for their clients, or if it's a civil, who gets it. So she does all the mathematical, putting the pins together. I support her in those investigations, giving her, if she needs, hey, I need a background check on this guy. I need to know about this guy. So I'll do my databases. I've got my PI license here in Montana, but I don't do PI work that's traditionally considered, like sit on a house. Right. My husband's cheating on me. I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
There's other PIs here in town. They're great. Experience. Let them do that. So I'm more supporting my wife. On my side of the firm is I provide security consulting for clients, Yellowstone Club type level people, high net worth people who want somebody to, a security guy who can come in and say, hey, here's a cyber company. Oh, you need cybersecurity? Let me reach out. I know this guy. Oh, you need executive protection? I know this guy. You need a canine who can stay in the family, but yet take out somebody who's an intruder. I got a guy. Mm. So I'm like the I got a guy person for these type of clients. Mm. Not just Yellowstone Club. I mean, if there's somebody here, in town that wants, assistance, I'm more than happy to provide that. I don't discriminate to say, but that's the clientele that I'm, we shoot for.
Got it.
We don't want to get 15 clients. We don't want 15 clients. We want to get 6 clients and give them exquisite service. Then getting 15 clients make more money, but yet I'm now spread out around 15 clients. That's why it's just the two of us, and we give very exclusive service to, hey, I've got you. You're getting my cell phone number. You need something, you give me a call directly. So that's the sort of things that we do now here in Bozeman.
Nice.
Awesome.
Well, go ahead. Speaking of Bozeman, some things that have been arising lately is something that's kind of in your area of expertise is organized crime, particularly what I'm thinking is Tren de Aragua.
Mm-hmm.
What do you know about this that's going on? Because they've only emerged in the last few months now.
Mm-hmm. No, they've been...
Publicly, they've only emerged in the last few months.
It wasn't really until Aurora and the apartment takeover that I ever heard of them at
all. That's half of the problem. Yeah. So the fact that it took an incident for people to really be talking about it. I knew about them over a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago. I knew about Tren de Aragua when I went to Ecuador to participate in a conference. And we were talking about TDA back then. Mm. This was while I was still an agent. And that they were an emerging threat, they were more dangerous than MS-13, and they were coming to the States. I mean, it was known, but they had just maybe entered Texas and a little bit of Florida. Excuse me. So we were looking at saying, hey, we need to be aware of this. We need to be prepared for it. Law enforcement needs to prepare for it. FBI needs to be prepared for it, HSI. And then I got out. The problem I found with federal law enforcement, I was just talking to a lieutenant in a police department in a predominantly Hispanic city where they have a lot of Spanish-speaking officers, detectives, and stuff like that. So they don't see this problem in places like San Diego or in southern Texas where they have a lot of Hispanic-speaking private detectives or investigators or agents. Mm-hmm. Majority of this country, the reason why I was hired is because you don't have a lot of investigators who speak Spanish. So getting into conducting these investigations is difficult for law enforcement. What is going to be soon becoming the predominant, ethnic community in this country is going to be Hispanics. Mm-hmm. And that's a fact of nature. I mean, that's just, and a lot of people speak Spanish, but that crime is here. Mm-hmm. So getting an investigator to get into a clique, a crew, is difficult if you don't speak Spanish. You can't flip a source. You can't talk to the residents. You can't talk to a restaurant owner and say, hey, tell me about this guy, or flip a guy. You have a PD that arrests, some guy right on the street. I would countless times go in there and listen to the interrogation. Would not be in the room as FBI agent Dan. I would just listen to the interrogation. And if I could hear that the PD was getting into this guy and could really get him, then I would come in. And guys were in the gang units or the criminal elements. They were afraid of police department, but they were terrified of the FBI. Mm. They're terrified of the FBI because it's a completely different subject that the FBI is looking at you. If cops are looking at you, okay, that's just part of the sport. If the FBI has got you, oh shit. Yeah. Right. So it completely changed. When I popped that badge and creds on the table, there you'd see like the white just like come over there for like, oh crap. And then when I sat down with them, and I spoke Spanish, it was another hammer. They're like, wow, this guy really... And then when I knew what meant, all the language, all the terms, and then they were like, wow, this guy really knows what he's talking about. Then it was just be like, okay, flip this guy. So it's those process of getting somebody and then getting them to flip is difficult for law enforcement. So it takes an Aurora to get into the media. Mm-hmm. Now, law enforcement knew about TDA, but it's not being talked about because, again, it's not... respected, I would say, is the right word. I don't know how to depart it. But it's difficult for law enforcement seniors and supervisors to say, hey, let's work a MS-13 Tren de Aragua case where we have a language barrier. Putting up a wire would be difficult. We got to bring in linguists. Mm-hmm. Or we got a Bloods or Crips or some set right here where it's English. We get in, we make the buys, we get in and we get out, and it's much faster.
It's a lamplighter problem, right? Yeah. So it's where you have assets and resources that you invest in rather than the areas that are outside the lamplight,
right.
In which case you don't invest it. So the only thing you see is
And
what
that's why
in.
I think those are some of the more dangerous, crimes because we're not paying the attention that needs to be paid to these crews. Mm. The guys that I still talk to across this country, FBI, local law enforcement type of thing, these guys are busting their butts because, you know, they're working hard. And they loved it that I'm getting out here and talking about it because it needs to be brought the attention. I knew Tren de Aragua was here in Bozeman about 8 months ago because I talked to people in the community. Mm-hmm. My special agent hat never has really left me. So I strike up relationships and conversations, and I can speak Spanish. So I strike up, I have a conversation with people around town who are in the Hispanic community, and they tell me things. Mm. So I knew TDA was here months ago, like 7 or 8 months ago. But I wasn't going to go out in the public and the media and say that, because if Bozeman PD or the Sheriff's Department were conducting an investigation, the fact that it gets out there in the media, if I put it out there, it could jeopardize something that they have going on.
Sure.
They utilize the cover of, hey, we're not talking about it. That helps the detectives. Mm-hmm.
Where is TDA from originally?
Venezuela.
Venezuela.
Yeah.
I've also heard that all three of the Mexican drug cartels, the major ones, are also operating in Bozeman.
I've heard CJNG, which is New Generation, and I heard Sinaloa. Those are the only two I've heard. I haven't heard a third one.
So what is your take on, because normally, like, and maybe this is just media bias, I don't know, but when you see on the news, you know, there are shootouts on the streets of some, you know, resort town in mm-hmm. Mexico between drug cartels.
Yeah.
If they're both here, or three of them are here, or maybe more of them are here, why isn't there that same degree of violence occurring in this community?
Well, I think that the cartels that move into a town or into a region already know what cartels are already there. So they're, I don't think that you're going to, because I think half of it has to do a lot with the corruption in Mexico. So that there's, you know, I don't know how many percentage of, you know, police officials are in the pockets of the cartels. So for them to have open battle and warfare on the streets of Acapulco or some other town in Mexico is a lot easier to fight. Because I mean, really is lawless in Mexico. There's certain towns, areas where you just be like, don't drive, don't go there.
Yeah. So they're a little more cautious here because there is just more of a legal framework.
I think so. I think that the hammer of God, and that's like the hammer of God would come down upon them. They know that if they were to do open warfare here, first of all, here in Montana, I mean, yeah. you may get rounds from the pickup truck next to you. Okay? So they know that there's multiple ways. It's not just law enforcement that would be taking them out. But in cities like New Jersey, there's a big difference between it. So I think that the amount of hammer that would come down on them, it would be exponential. It would be a lot worse on them. So I don't think we're going to, I'd be very shocked. On the border, maybe a little bit more fighting for, like, you know, roots into the United States.
Yeah.
But I don't think we're going to see open warfare between the cartels here.
What are they doing here? Business?
Business as usual. I have understood that there are a lot of work on the reservations. I've heard that they've set up shops on the reservations because it's federal law enforcement can't go on the reservations without permission. They have to be asked to come on the reservation. So FBI, HSI, ATF, DEA, they're all handcuffed. So you've got that number one problem. So whether they are, you know, paying certain people off at the reservation, I don't know. One of the things I've heard what they've done is they will, a cartel member will find a single woman who has a home and say, I'll pay you $50,000 to marry me. She's going to say, okay. And then he now marries her and moves into that house. And he's now set up a legal resident of the reservation. Mm-hmm. So he's set up ship. Now I've heard that they've come down, but one pill of meth was, it's $6 to $8 at the border, and it was somewhere about $80 to $100 here on the reservations.
Good
so
ROI.
Significantly wow. different on the reservation. I don't know how it is here in town.
Those are Bitcoin numbers, Kyle.
Yeah, yes, seriously. So yeah, so there you got some serious action on the reservation to be there.
So it's drugs predominantly, or human trafficking, or
there is. So yeah, so that's where an element where TDA will come in. TDA is very good at human trafficking and, you know, prostitution, and then, you know, bringing the immigrants up from the border. And their payment is, hey, you need to, you know, especially females, you need to work for the gang for the next year. As soon as the year is up, they don't let them go. But, you know, so that's where they make their money. They stay in the communities. So I'm working with a couple guys here from town to put together a task force with Dustin Diefendurfer over at Mountain Tough to put together a task force to work with law enforcement, but to be an entity out here and double up. So we will find these houses of sexual, you know, prostitution and the pedophiles and that those sort of thing, and conduct an investigation in line with law enforcement to collect the evidence correctly. And then once we have him captured, then we hand him over to law enforcement, and it's all, you know, in accordance, working with the DA, getting it turned over to the law enforcement entity that we have. But it's manned primarily 80% of the unit is civilians. So
interesting. So I know you've answered this on previous podcasts, but for our listeners who might be asking why Bozeman, could you answer that? Like, why are they here? I know you said construction leading to a lot of it.
Yeah, I think the construction that there is just so way it works in the Latin community is when one person finds an opportunity for work, then other family members will come up, and then you'll be like, oh, there's work up there. Okay, let me come with you. So you just have a migration of people, and the construction boom up here in town is just, you know, second to none, as you guys know. So there's a lot of construction, and I've talked to people who are directly, you know, have seen, you know, gang members mm-hmm. as part of construction crews, mm-hmm. Both at the Yellowstone Club or here in town. They're here. They're part of it. Not everybody in the construction crew is a gang member. Right. Let me be very clear about that. But they are there. They're part of it.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Well, they got to work too. Right.
I mean, they do.
It's not a full-time job necessarily being a gang member, right?
In 2015, when I had a case in New Jersey on MS-13, all the guys had day jobs. They were working, they were roofing. They were they were putting on new roofs. And then at night and on the weekends, they were gangbanging. They were shooting and killing people, and they were doing their thing.
Wow.
So it was it was an ongoing process. You know, it's only like the people that are at the cartel level. You know, that don't have day jobs.
So return back to the Aurora apartment situation, which is just a couple apartment buildings, right? It's not like a big deal. What does the gang get out of taking over an apartment building? Like, what's the motive for
control?
Doing that?
Control, money.
Extortion, right?
Like extortion. Yeah. Okay. I knew a couple months before it broke in the news, because the building owners had reached out to me. They knew I was a civilian now. They knew what I did. And they were like, hey, what do we do? It's this way. Can you guide us? And then I was finding out that they were extorting. They were literally going to the building owners and saying, we will collect the rent for you from now on. We will take half the rent and we'll give you the other half. So they were taking all the rent. They were doing the rent collecting and giving only half to the building owners. And when the building owners kind of said, well, you know, what the fuck? They beat the shit out of one of their guys.
Whoa.
So there was literally like the intimidation of like, you're going to do what we say, whether you like it or not. So they were doing the extortion, and that's just a base of operations for weapons. You saw in the video the guys were having long guns, and it's just for them to be able to. This is nothing new. This is nothing. The Aurora situation is not a new situation. They did this in Chile. They've done this in Peru. They did this for years before they were doing it here in the United States. And the reason why they were doing it so well in Aurora, and they were doing it so well in El Paso, taking over the hotel, is because the guys that were doing that were doing it in Chile years ago, and then they were getting the experience. And then when, you know, Chilean law enforcement had closed in on them, and they were like, okay, these guys are wanted, you know, TDA law, leadership would say, all right, guys, pack up, you're moving into the United States, and they would smuggle them up to the United States. So now they're wanted in Chile, but they've disappeared, and they've disappeared here in the United States.
What is the power structure like of a group like TDA? Like, how much of, like, how decentralized is it? How much, like, central authority is there? What's the economics of this? Like, I've heard you talk about President Maduro kind of giving the approval and just giving off gold mines to TDA. And, like, how is that money filtering into these gang members? Like, how does that all work?
So that's being figured, that's part of the investigation. Yeah. And obviously, I don't want to jeopardize any ongoing investigations and letting TDA know, because I assume, you know, assuming TDA is going to watch this. So I don't want to, you know,
divulge.
Hey, like, subscribe, Discord. Hey, listen,
leave a comment.
Leave a comment. You know, I'm sure, hey, listen, more likes, more views. Hey, whoever wants to watch it.
So we got a massive spike in Venezuela. Our Venezuelan audience is huge.
Yeah, we got Ireland, Norway, and Venezuela. And Venezuela.
Nice. Crushing it.
So it's yeah, you know, yeah, exactly. So we're where was I going with that?
Yeah. The power structure.
I think the larger question is just like, how much is this like top down directed and how much of it's decentralized on the ground?
So I think it's, so from what we understand is it's not as, so MS-13 was very, very controlling. Very, very much like you did not do something without approval by the higher ups in Mexico or El Salvador. So MS-13 middle leadership was set up in Mexico. Senior leadership is in El Salvador. And they were very much like, you want to do something in New Jersey, you have to request it from me, and I request it up the chain of command. So it was very, very centralized. Whereas TDA is a little bit different. There is a leadership structure, but it's less like you have to ask permission. Mm-hmm. There is a control, there is communications. They do, you know, communicate through secure apps. They are working together. We've known proof by that U.S. entities are working with South American entities and they're working together. So there may be a kidnapping in South America, but yet the entities here in the United States are doing the collecting on the ransom.
Wow.
So they're working together. There's clear coordination. And anybody that says they're not sophisticated is, you know, full of shit. Mm. So they are a sophisticated organization. They're working in Bitcoin. They're money laundering in the gold mines. They're being moved, they're selling in the United States, and how that money is getting moved around is like for another story, for another time, but they're recycling that money into the organization, and that money is going to be used to move personnel from Venezuela through Mexico to the United States, where then they can further their cause. Now, where do I think that one of the questions was asked to me is, do you think that there's leadership going, okay, I want you to go to Montana, I want you to go to California? I don't think so. I think what they're looking at now is saying, okay, where is there a Venezuelan community? Let's have you go to Montana. There's a big Venezuelan community up there. Let's have you go to New York. There's a community up there. So where there's Venezuelan communities is where they're moving to, because that's where they want to, that's where they want to get the money from. It's because they're not going to be able to extort El Salvadorians, but you go to a Venezuelan who's got family back in Caracas. Hey, you need to pay me $100 or your mom back home is going to get a visit. Mm. So that's why, and they can blend into a Venezuelan community much better than an El Salvadorian community. Mm-hmm. So that's where we need to look for, is where there's Venezuelan strongholds and community. And in Bozeman, you have three communities, Honduran, Venezuelans, and Mexicans. Those are the three predominant Hispanic groups here in Bozeman.
I'm curious, from a perspective of an FBI agent, a lot of the crackdown on crypto has been an argument about its facility for these kind of transactions, how it can move value over state lines without permission, like in a SWIFT system or a bank transfer or something like that. It's a lot easier to do in Bitcoin, but they're even doing it on gold. If they're using gold as a medium exchange, each of these, or cash, right? If they're moving cash, has the same problem. So how do you kind of think about that from your background of, you know, financial freedom in these industries versus like cracking down on the actual, you know, platforms themselves to move value around?
Well, listen, you have to talk to somebody else who's in the FinCEN investigations. I mean, I really was a gang guy and this never came up in my investigations. Mm. So I wasn't able to really, you know, grasp it as far as the law enforcement perspective is concerned. Mm. But, you know, there has to be a balance. There has to be, listen, and it's just like, you can't, you know, hammer down on somebody's free. Like, for example, one thing that was asked to me is like, there was a lot of carjackings and one TV station, you know, had me come on and they say, you know, the industry, you know, is there something the car industry can do to make it more difficult for, you know, people robbing cars, you know, the people who are robbing? Yeah, you can, but that's then taking away from the customer the ease of getting into a car and doing that in the computer and keyless, and that's what people want.
Right.
So where do you find the balance of, you know, impeding on people's freedoms of enjoying the products that they want, the legal, you know, good people of this country, or, you know, versus that. So I think that, you know, like I said, I'm definitely the wrong person to talk about crypto. But like I said, these different ways, the bad thing about it is I've found that, especially I've found in federal law enforcement, the bad guys always are a step ahead of us. Because they utilize the latest in tech, they use the latest in AI, and where the government, you know, as an agent, we are restricted. Agents are restricted to use only the databases and only the means that is approved by the government. Mm-hmm. So it has to go through the government cycle to see, hey, can we use this? And that takes months, if not years, for a computer program or something for the investigators to use. Meanwhile, you know, the bad guys are, you know, a mile ahead. Mm-hmm. So it's really a battle, you know, with the advancement of technology and AI and, you know, all the different databases, the different apps. You know, a lot of these apps utilize, you know, privacy that the companies won't, you know, won't give us. So, you know, it's encrypted. Mm-hmm. So it's a difficult balance, you know. I mean, getting into the smartphone, which the shooter at the healthcare CEO, getting into that phone, and, you know, depending on what version of the phone it is, because Apple is not going to cooperate, even with a search warrant. They're going to say no, you know. So it's difficult.
Yeah, if they don't have the keys, if the keys are private as opposed to
right.
non-encrypted,
correct,
and non-private. So that's the kind of the question is like, how do you balance? How do you think of how the FBI should balance the privacy of Americans versus the security question? At the end of the day, is going to be, you know, lots of people are going to draw that line differently. And what we see is like a top-down solution that's very much we're going to undermine crypto. That we've seen that from the Federal Trade Commission and a lot of the crypto policies.
Operation usually, choke point.
Yeah, like are that, usually right. done in order to, you know, under the ostensible, it's kind of questionable whether it's their true motivation or not.
Right.
Against terrorism or yep. gangs and cartels versus the privacy question
yep.
for individual Americans.
Yeah.
A similar question. You mentioned El Salvador mm-hmm. and the international dynamic with their new president. Mm-hmm. And all the pressure he's getting on his crackdown against the cartels. How do you think about that? And you know they've gone from the highest murder rate in the world.
Yeah, but at what cost?
To the lower. Yeah, that's the question. How do you think about that?
And I can't you know how many people are in this new Supermax jail are in prison, and they had nothing to do with the gang, and they're just sweeping arrests. Mm-hmm. And I look at it this way that. Nothing is always clean. Mm-hmm. Okay. Nothing is always clean. There's some dirty stuff that's obviously, it's never been like, oh, this was great. We swept up all the gang members. No. There's some stuff that's going on behind the scenes to make this happen. Whether somebody gets trampled on, or whether somebody gets stepped on, or whether somebody's get their civil rights abused. No, I am not a fan of Bukele. And what he's done. Yes, El Salvador has turned into one of the cleanest countries in the world and safest countries in the world, but at what cost? We don't know. Yeah. And it looks great in the media. It looks great on Twitter. It looks great on, you know, tweeting and, you know, Instagramming. Oh, look how safe it is. And, mm-hmm. you know, he's there. He's a young guy and everything. But at what cost? So I think there's a lot that we're not seeing that's behind the curtain. That, you know, it's kind of like, yeah. Oh, there's nothing to see. Look how great this is over here. Yeah. And then this person is getting shoved down over here.
Well, and I think the case there is something like civil liberties are unseen, murder correct. Seen, right? So if someone has their civil liberties violated, yeah. it's harder. You can't measure that like you can a murder rate. So what you find, just lamplight
effect. And also
again.
Because, listen, yeah. El Salvador is an extremely, extremely small country. Mm. So if you had somebody speak up, they would immediately get trampled on. I mean, it's a small, I mean, I think maybe the size of Rhode Island. Mm. So I think there's a vast difference between El Salvador and the United States that if somebody were to speak up here in the United States, there's enough, you know, both sides of the media that would, you know, echo that their statements. Somebody in El Salvador were to say that, you know, Bukele will come down and just be like, nope, and shut them down. Mm. You know, as far as, you know, him controlling the press, him controlling the media, and, you know, saying the right things, you know, so it has to be. So I think that there's a measure of that.
That's a valid criticism.
Yeah, sure. Really quick, going back to you kind of saying criminals are always one step ahead. I kind of want to talk about the lack of an immigration policy from the most recent, the Biden administration.
Yeah.
How much does that kind of put agents behind the ball, like playing catch up with just a wide open border?
TDA is the perfect example.
Yeah.
So TDA, like I said, was at the border in March of 2013. They were in the United States. There's not, you know, I'm not going to lie about it. I mean, they were just kind of, now there's somewhere between 3,000 to 5,000 members. That doesn't happen naturally. Okay. That's an artificial. And the only way I can attribute to that is the border situation where it was wide open. Now the Democrats want to yell, hey, we have the, you know, the fewest, you know, immigration in the last, the last 8 months. How about the years before years. That? We're not talking about that. Right. You're talking about the last 8 months. Sure. Yeah. The numbers are down. But what about everything else, those last 3 years? And one of the things I like to do is talk about is the 10% rule, okay? The 10% rule, as I say, you know, however many people come across the border, 90% are good people. 90% are looking for a better opportunity. Hey, listen, they're still committing a crime coming into this country. Mm-hmm. They're committing federal violation, but they're coming here to get a job at Dole and working fruit picking and or working landscaping or working
construction,
right. Yeah. 10% of those, of all people crossing the border, are coming here for nefarious reasons. Mm. To commit crime, terrorism, exploitation, spying. You know, you've got, you know, the Chinese government. We know that the Chinese, I don't want to say the wrong number, but I think that the number of Chinese, military-aged men that came in during the Trump administration was, I want to say, like double digits. Mm. And then I know it was triple digits, if not more, during the Biden administration. Those exact numbers, I'm not quite sure. I know, but it's a huge percentage of increase. Mm. And that shows. So that you've got military age men, and you've got, you know, those from Iran have been captured. Iranians, ISIS members, you know, Syrians coming across the border, gang members, and they're coming to the United States to commit crimes. Mm. So 15 million, say, were encounters at the border in those first 3 years, 10% of those for me. So, yeah, I think that those were the all TDA members that came over, through the open door. And, yeah, that never happened of, like, the artificial, this blowing up of a gang just so quickly of a brand new organization. Hmm. But now it's too late.
Is that just super demoralizing, though, as an agent?
No. When we saw these numbers, you're just like, and I would talk to ICRO deportation officers I'm very close with, and they were like, and we just look at the numbers, we'd look at the TV, we'd have the TVs on in our squad area, and be like, just like
FUBAR.
Yeah. Yeah. You're just like, all right, well, this is it. And job security, you're going to have cases coming up. So, it was tough.
Question on the 10% rule, actually, real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is that a statistical?
No.
Or is it more anecdotal?
That's just me going, probably.
1 in 10, usually.
1 in 10, mm-hmm. Right. That's me. That's definitely not anybody who did a scientific test.
Okay.
That's just me kind of like, that's probably about right.
Yeah. From your experience?
Yes.
Yeah.
I want to bring in a question from the Discord. We have a question from ECH in the Discord who wants to ask about the China connection. What exactly is the connection between the cartels and China? Is the Chinese government directly involved or complicit in the trafficking of drugs and precursor chemicals, or are there degrees of separation?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The Chinese are. So it's been, this is not a secret, and this has been, we've been talking about. So for years, there's been what's called the pink wave down in South America. So Latin America has always traditionally, I guess it goes along the lines of the same as, conducting the investigations. Latin America for business has always been second fiddle to Europe. And that's the way it's been. That's the way it still is. The Chinese and the Russians, to some point, have moved in and have been working openly to very much. So if for people who are from the Northeast, John Gotti was a mob boss. He was head of the Gotti, the Gambino crime family. And what he did in New York City is his two or three little blocks, he would pay for everything. He would buy new roads. He would have parties. He would have street fairs. So the people loved him because they took care of him. They didn't care about the other stuff. They just were like, you're building. That's what the Chinese are doing. The Chinese are doing that now in Peru. And I just posted an article on my LinkedIn about this, where I want to say it was like 3 weeks ago, they officially took over a major shipping port in Peru. The Chinese, a Chinese company, which has clear ties to the Chinese intelligence, has paid $2.2 billion to take over a shipping port off of the coast of Peru. And they additional $1.2 billion will be infused into the port. This now gives them control to move major products in the Pacific Ocean. And the amount, the, what that means is obviously, you know, narcotics, you move it in and out, bringing in supplies, and then controlling the means. This is the, and you know, the Chinese have been known to be building roads. That's why you see so many governments in South America in the past 10 years swung to the left with socialist leadership.
Yeah, this is the Belt and Road Initiative, what you're referring
Belt
to, right?
Belt and Road, yes.
Yeah, so one of the ways that I conceptualize this, and I want to know what you think about it, is it's kind of a mercantilist, if you're familiar with the economics of mercantilism, blowback to American mercantilism, right? So mm-hmm. for all this time, we use the IMF and the UN and these liberal institutions in the post-World War II era to push a very similar thing. When we say, like, hey, you need to develop this, you're going to get this loan from the IMF. And, you know, there's all kinds of criticism there. It's well seen about how the U.S. kind of does similar things. And now the Chinese are kind of getting into the same market of sort to try to do that. Do you see that as competition in that space, or do you see this as a unique threat and difference?
I look at this as a threat. Mm. So everybody is you know, the subject that, you know, the thing that nobody wants to talk about, and a lot of people are talking about it, is the impending invasion of Taiwan. Mm. That China is lining up and preparing for an invasion of Taiwan in either fall of 27 or spring of 28, depending on the tide cycle. That they're building their navy, they're building their infrastructure. This is one of the pieces. If they control the shipping lanes here in the Pacific, they may be able to influence, you know, the U.S. Navy's response to a Chinese invasion. Mm-hmm. So if we lose Taiwan, that's 92% of the microchips in everything that we use. Mm-hmm. That's 92% there in Taiwan. So Chinese taking over Taiwan, which has always been one of the things they want, they bring it back to the motherland. But that's also a financial, because, you know, the population of China is going down because of their one child rule. Mm-hmm. So they're the number of men. So they have a clear future over the next 20 to 30 years that they're going to be in the hurt locker. So they need to make moves. Now the Chinese Navy can't compete with our Navy. I mean, we've got 12 aircraft carriers. They have two. Mm-hmm. But they can put a hurting on if they put the numbers out there. Controlling the shipping lanes, controlling supply lines, that's how you strangle an army or a Navy. So this could be, like I said, for me, this is pre-positioning, you know, mm-hmm. chess pieces. Mm-hmm. That's for me.
Okay.
Now, you know, as far as, you know, mercantile, as far as a business perspective, I wouldn't be educated enough to be able to give you an opinion on that.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, obviously, I mean, mine, you know, money wise, if you can take away money from U.S., you know, U.S. government or U.S. Businesses, hey, plus for China.
Right. That's that. And it's also like competitive resources, right? So they want access to assets that they can then use to move shipping and things like that, just to have markets that they can access the same way that we do,
right?
Or other countries do.
Yep.
Traditionally, it's just, and then you can charge premium rates, things like that, and it could be a tool of statecraft. There's no doubt about that, right? We know that we use, for example, we monitor oil shipping liners in order to know where they're at, so that we can divert them from ports that we don't like and things like that as well. So these are all just like the statecraft kind of level that kind of goes unseen.
Right.
At the level of the public. Generally.
Yep. Yeah. No, and that's the unfortunate thing is you know, you have this port in Peru that just got taken over, and mm-hmm. I mean, no one really knows about it here, and
I don't know about it.
Right. that's the thing is that the threat, the danger that poses. But here's the thing is that port in Peru is only a small cog in the mm-hmm. everything that has happened in South America, the pink mm-hmm. wave,
right.
the amount of influence China has, you know. Let's put all our money into this presidential nominee and saying, hey, you want me to build a road? Or why don't you vote for this guy? Mm-hmm. So that's where you've seen a lot of socialist, you know, governments. And then you have blowbacks like you did in Chile when they tried to do a constitutional. So they tried to rewrite the constitution in Chile mm-hmm. to be very socialist. Mm-hmm. And the mandate was put out to the people and 92% said, hell no. So that, you know, that's my family down there. And I'm like, yeah, good job. And then in Argentina, you say, you know, the election of
Milei.
So you're seeing the swing left and right, but there's other countries that are not swinging.
What do you think of Milei? Have you looked into him a bunch at all?
I like him. I want to still see, you know, you know, I what's the danger of any politics is that if you swing too hard one way, the swing is going to come back the other way. So I think that a swing in a direction is good, but if you swing too hard, it could smash you in the face, because if A, your policies don't work, or something fails, or the people just don't like it, mm-hmm. then you're going to lose the next election. So yeah. It's kind of like you have to balance act.
For sure.
Find the right balance.
Do you think he's swinging too hard in that direction?
I haven't done enough research, but the things I've seen, I think I like it. I like it, you know, because Argentina was pretty screwed up.
Yeah.
Their money, financially, they were pretty screwed up. So at this point, it's kind of like, got nothing to lose.
Yeah.
You know?
Totally.
So I like what he's been doing.
Cool. Yeah, it seems like he's been successful so far.
Right.
So and a similar kind of, we do the same thing. This might be too long because I know we have a break coming in a minute. So if it's too long of an answer, that's all right. We'll come back to it. Cheryl has a question.
Yes.
About the U.S. government funding the drug trade, mm-hmm. specifically thinking of Iran-Contra to other examples of foreign intelligence specialist services like the CIA moving drugs into America and selling it. How much is the government doing that versus fighting the drug trade in your assessment?
Well, listen, I'm only going to speak from my perspective of what I know as an agent for my 20 years and the 9 years in the Navy. I've never encountered a CIA officer as one of my subjects. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to say, you know, yes, it is happening. I don't know enough to know about that. So to say, you know, that there is a grand conspiracy, obviously they do happen. Iran-Contra, the
Fast and Furious.
Fast and the Furious. Yeah. They happen. I've never been experienced to them, you know, in my gang world. Do I think it's possible? Maybe.
Well, maybe a second thought on that is because similar to what we do in, say, the Middle East or Ukraine, like we'll fund a neo-Nazi group in Ukraine in kind of this proxy battle. We'll fund various rebel groups in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And would it be reasonable to think of like us kind of being engaged with certain cartels to fight against the other foreign-backed cartels? And is there kind of like proxy cartel battles are going on there?
Listen, I would be... From the FBI's perspective, as an agent for my 20 years, I would be beyond stunned to say that we get into bed with cartels. I've never been a CIA agent. I've never been an operative overseas. Yeah. So I don't know what happens overseas. And I don't know anything about the CIA. And I'm not going to begin to speculate and say, I'm not going to speculate about that. Mm-hmm. As far as the FBI is concerned, as an FBI agent, I would be beyond stunned that would happen. Now, if you had told me the day before Fast and Furious came out that we were, you know, sending weapons, I would have said the same thing about ATF. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to say, definitively, but in my experience, FBI in Newark and the agents that I work with, there's no way in hell we were getting in bed with cartel members. There's a very, very strict requirements for running sources in the FBI. You have to submit them. They have to be approved by higher management. And I ran under, in FBI, most divisions, you have the special agent in charge, and which is the head boss of the entire division. And then you had like five ASACs who were like XOs, and they are in charge of different branches. So I had the criminal ASAC was over me. And almost every single criminal ASAC would say absolutely not to pedophiles. Even it doesn't matter what you were, I don't care if he provides us, you know, the JFK assassin. You weren't getting into bed with right. And that's because that's showing who the FBI is getting into relationships with. Mm-hmm. So, and then there's clear paperwork. So there's no, okay, maybe we'll do this on the cuff or, hidden. That never happened with me or the experiences that I had.
Yeah. I mean, and people sometimes, if you're not dealing in the space, don't recognize the differences between the FBI and the CIA beyond just one's domestic and one's foreign, even as the CIA has gotten more.
And that's one of the things that upsets me so much these days is that everybody gets on the internet and everybody's, you know, has access and everybody has freedom of speech. And I'm totally, that's why I spent 29 years. You can say what you want. You can do what you want. I'm absolutely fine. But the people who are the critics of the FBI, it's a corrupt organization. It's corrupt to the core. How many years have you been an FBI agent? How many years you've been in law enforcement? Okay. Right. And, you know, the people that speak, well, I know that you guys had the authority to shoot and kill when you did Mar-a-Lago, the search warrant. No, that's not because you heard that from some pundit who is trying to get a 15 second. The fact of the matter is Every search warrant, every arrest warrant that's ever conducted by the FBI has the deadly force policy, which tells you exactly what you can and cannot do. And you cannot shoot unless these lines are met. And they're very strict. And if these lines are not met, you cannot shoot. So that was what that deadly force policy was. So yes, when we enter a residence to, we don't have our guns drawn. We're asking for a search warrant. But if somebody poses a threat of imminent bodily danger,
yeah.
Yes, deadly force may be used. Uh-huh. Doesn't mean says will be used, mm-hmm. may be used. So we don't want to use deadly force. So everybody, and that's what I'm talking about, is that those are the things that say, listen, if you're not from that world, okay, I'm not saying you can't talk about it, but just understand that you may be wrong.
So on our podcast, we've talked quite a bit in covering stories, historical and more recent, about intelligence community broadly, of areas of concern. And I think this played in a narrative in this last election cycle too, with the Trump administration's concerned over the intelligence communities and what they see as a high-level problem, but possibly a mid and low-level problem too. So a range of different things that people think about when they think about FBI problems is, and most recently would be Russiagate. And the use of a FISA warrant in order to spy on the Trump campaign based upon a CIA asset that turned out, you know, to be under investigation by the FBI, and the FBI failed to ever report that that CIA asset was actually, you know, an asset of the U.S. government, and use that as an excuse to spy on the Trump campaign. Now, the theory, the motive there is that the FBI high-level folks were going to back-channel information about the Russia campaign to the Hillary Clinton campaign. But we don't know that. A guy went to prison for the abuse of a FISA warrant, but we'd never really gone any further than that. So I just wanted your thoughts on, and I think people are, Cheryl and, you know, our audience could be very interested, as a person on the ground, how you think about that kind of high-level problems from the FBI.
Well, listen, I feel like that the FBI is just like any other business organization across in the world. You know, you're never going to find an organization that's perfect. So I kind of refer back to an interview I saw this morning of a member of who's a QAnon conspiracy theorist. He does radio shows, and he believes in QAnon. And he says 99% of the FBI is perfectly fine. It's the 1% we got to get rid of. Okay, well, that's your opinion on who the 1% is. Mm-hmm. Your opinion of the 1% is different than your opinion of the 1%. So everybody has a different opinion on the 1%. Mm-hmm. Listen, the FBI is not perfect. I'm the first one to say that there are problems, that there is, you know, always room for improvement. Every organization has room for improvement. The FBI currently, as is, I believe, is a good organization. It should be great. It should be great. And I believe that there is, and I believe that this has nothing to do with the FBI. It doesn't have to do with politics. I believe this is a generational thing, that one of the, and this is not a secret, is one of the reasons why I left the Bureau was I was sick and tired of those above me that were forgetting where they came from, that why we are here. We are street agents. We are here to investigate violations of federal crime. That's it. Has nothing to do with politics, Democrats, Republicans, sexuality, religion. Has nothing to do with it. If you violate it, if we believe it's probable cause, that's the imperative word. That's the important word. If you believe that a violation of federal crime has been committed or will be committed, you can open up a case. You don't have to open up a case because a crime has been committed. Yeah, I mean, yes, if a crime has been committed, you can open up a case. But if you have believed that a case, that there's a federal violation, that gives you justification to open up a federal investigation, no matter who, what, when, where, why. So if you can justify it, you can say, I believe that a violation of this crime is or will be committed, you can open up a federal investigation. It doesn't matter the agency, FBI, I believe DEA and ATF are probably the same. But once you've opened up the investigation, you have to, depending on the level, you have to get certain approvals from those that are above you, higher ups. Me, I had direct experience on this where I had numerous times where I had to request, because a lot of my investigations had international ramifications. So I had to ask permission from those above me. When I have to ask those, a lot of times these agents who have been 5 years, 10 years removed from cases, at being a case agent, they're sitting there reading it, and all they're doing is reading the file. you know, whatever, not even reading the file. They're reading the piece of paper with the permission. Hey, this is what has been done. This is what's been done. This is what we want to do. They'll look at it and go, this is a bad guy doing bad things, but it could go bad if it doesn't go exactly as planned, because it's international ramifications and it might piss somebody off the State Department. And you know what? I've got the promotion that's coming up, you know, next year, and I'm going to put in for it. If it goes bad and I piss off people at the State Department, if the State Department calls over here and calls the bosses above me, then they may not take me. You know what? Let's wait on this project. Let's shelf it. Let's talk about it in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. That's the response I got so many times. Let's talk about it in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So people, the further up the chain of command you went, this is less at the FBI, much more at the DOJ. You went up the chain of command, you forgot why you're there. Mm. And they were more worried about their next promotion and going. And again, that's why I look at this as a generational thing. And you could see this at different companies. And the same thing, it has nothing to do with FBI or DOJ. It's just the mentality of, I have to beat that person. I have to be that the next promotion, or else I'm just going to stay here, or I'm going to get demoted, or I'm just going to flatline and be level here. So that's where I think it is the cleaning of the house. Yeah. And for my opinion, I am not, you know, I was in the gang world. So what I know about the investigation you refer to is what I know from the media. Mm-hmm. Okay. And it all depends on what media outlet you listen to and what social medias you listen to is the perspective of the investigation. Okay. Unless you were a part of the investigation, unless you were one of the people overseeing it, you don't know. You don't know what happened. I've always, in my cases, whenever they broke in the media, 50% of what's reported by the media is filler. They filled it in to make a story. Okay. So I can't comment on the Russia investigation because I'm not, you know, I'm not in a position to say, yes, this is what happened or this is, if there was, but I look at it at the, for me, it's the origins. You know, people are saying, you know, how dare they open that investigation? How dare they do this? If there can be, you know, it can be articulated that there is probable cause that a federal violation of federal laws, which are in paper, then an investigation can be opened, regardless of who it is. Yeah. Regardless.
So another question kind of in the will be committed question is the narrative that's kind of risen since the global war on terror till today on FBI entrapment as a defense against FBI like sting operations, things like that. And the most recent one, and there are a bunch of them, but the most recent one is the Governor Whitmer case.
Okay.
Where it's been accused that out of the 14 people that were accused of planning to abduct Governor Whitmer and possibly commit a murder, 12 of them were FBI informants.
That would be very surprising. I mean, if that was actually factual, if 12 of the 14 that were charged were FBI informants?
Well, it's strange because the way the media talks about it, and this is just people on the outside trying to make sense of their world, right? These are people who are in good faith saying, okay, I'm looking at a news report that says 12 informants on this, right? Because this is a part of the defense, the public case of the defense, and there are 14 people being charged. Now, is there 26 people in a group and 12 of them are informants? That's still a lot.
Yeah.
And then second, if the argument in court was, well, they didn't actually have a plan until the informant came to them with a plan. They didn't have any resources until the informant provided resources. There wasn't really this is just a bunch of people who wouldn't have committed it if it weren't for the FBI becoming involved.
And what you just said right there, that's the important thing. Yeah. The that is, for me, was one of the things I learned, the defense. If that individual cannot rob the bank, but for the assistance of him, then that could be considered entrapment. So if you think about it, and then you utilize giving him the tools without him asking for the tools. Now, if you ask him, you say, hey, listen, I want to rob this bank. Can you give me the car? I want the guns, you know, and you are asking for that. Then that's not entrapment because you're literally requesting it. You're requesting the guns, the car, and everything like that to facilitate you robbing the bank. I would be very, very, very skeptical and shocked to hear if that is true, that the of however many defendants, there were 12 of them were informants. For me, I want to find out who wrote that article and what their definition of informant is. Now, I have had cases where we've gone to trial and we've had, I think 9 were indicted, and once we've indicted them, a lot of them flip and become cooperating witnesses.
Right.
And they testify. So that's not an informant. That's not an informant, somebody who cooperates with the government after the arrest.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's
right.
A cooperating witness.
Yeah.
An informant is somebody who is working and actively being tasked by the FBI mm-hmm. during the course of the investigation. Now, every single one of these informants, I am sure that this investigation was coordinated by the FBI Detroit. They had very close oversight because of the danger to the government and then to Governor Whitner and all that. So the fact that if there was a, whoever was the ASAC and the SAC and FBI Detroit, I highly, highly, highly doubt that they would be okay with 12 informants working the investigation, being part of it. Mm-hmm. But like I said, this is the information you're debating. I am only familiar with that case from the media. But I would be very skeptical.
Well, me too. I mean, your careerism argument works at that level too, right? You're the one who gets to bust the case that is going to threat to an actual governor. That's a big deal for that person. Yeah. Right? So if they're motivated by, if careerism is the problem, that could be the problem on that level too, right?
Right. But you got to understand, the investigations are not only solely run by the FBI. Mm-hmm. They're run with the DOJ. You have a U.S. attorney. So every investigation that the FBI runs is with the mindset, and everyone that I case is with the mindset that this is going to go to trial. Mm. That's why, police departments, they make arrests based on probable cause. And a lot of times they put the pieces into the equation after the fact, then for the DA to charge. The FBI works the other way around. The FBI gathers all the evidence and we're anticipating we are going to go to trial with this. Mm. So that's why I believe the number is 86% of all FBI cases that are arrested never see a day in court because the individual sees such overwhelming evidence against them, they'll take the plea.
Right.
So for example, one of my investigations, we had murder in the aid of racketeering. So RICO cases, murder in the aid of racketeering. If I go to trial with you on murder in the aid of racketeering and you're convicted, that's mandatory life sentence. There's only one sentence, life. With a plea on a shooter, you could get 25 years. That's on a plea agreement. Plead guilty. That doesn't mean you're cooperating. That means you're just pleading guilty. All right, send me to jail. You cooperate and you testify in the court, in the trial, you're going to get less than 20 years. Mm-hmm. So it's a balancing act. So the DOJ, the U.S. Attorney's Office, I know they had to be involved from the beginning on this one. They're working and they want to know every single informant. They want to know every single piece of evidence and they're going to collect it all and they're going to be there. So there isn't just FBI running the investigation. There's oversight. Not to mention, I am sure the Michigan State Police was involved in that one.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, going back to what you said about kind of agents and people that rise up through the ranks of the FBI, forgetting mm-hmm. where they came from and kind of being more focused on the next promotion than doing great work in the field or doing great work at their job in that case. That's exactly what we've heard from Kash Patel, who is obviously just nominated for mm-hmm. FBI director. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that nomination? How do you feel like that's going to impact the Bureau overall if he does get confirmed?
Well, I think Kash Patel, it's no secret that I've been on other interviews that I think there were better picks. I think there were better selections for than Director Ray. I think Director Ray is, he's a good director. Not a great director. Is a good director. Replacing him, I don't think, is the right move. But, President-elect Trump has every right to do it, to shake things up. And I think that's good thing. I think it's going to be, I'd like to see where it goes. What I'd like for Mr. Patel to do when he comes in is, and I've seen him on other podcasts, I've seen where he said, I'm going to come in and close the Hoover building and send it. And that's where I'm saying is, listen, stop. Slow down, because you're talking. Your statement, what you said on that podcast was, "I'm going to shut the Hoover Building down and send the 7,000 employees out into the field. Go arrest bank robbers. Go do business." Of those 7,000, 6,000 are not gun carrying agents. Those are intelligence analysts, support employees. They're not agents. They don't carry guns. They don't do arrests. And you have to have a command structure. You have to have leadership. So what would you say? Just close the White House? No, you have to need a president. You have to have a Pentagon. You have to have a DEA headquarters. You have to have an FBI headquarters. So you have to have that. Now, whether that FBI headquarters belongs in Washington, D.C., I know that the conversation has been had, hey, they're it's scheduled to be built when a new FBI building is supposed to be built out in, I believe it's Maryland, mm-hmm. or I think there was two sites, and that was controversial in itself. But all I want him to do is listen, come in, evaluate. You were not sit, you know, you're basing your opinions on the FBI from the outside, from your position where you were at DNI or Pentagon. You're basing it from the outside, and you saw, you know, investigations and background and things like that. And that's great. That's fine. But once you're on the inside and you see inside the building, then you're going to learn it from a different perspective. Figure out how the FBI runs. Talk to the assistant directors who are in charge, who have been, you know, yes, the career guys, and maybe those guys need to go. Maybe they need to be part of the cleaning house. But coming in there on day one, and I mean, obviously he's not going to do that.
Right.
That's just a lot of rhetoric. I understand that you can't do that. But it's coming in and learning about, you know, how an organization of 35,000 is run. I know Mr. Patel doesn't have a lot of experience running organizations. I believe he was a chief of staff, and he has a couple other oversights. But he's never run an organization of 35,000. Hey, listen, you want to come in, become the director? Good for you. But come, take a pause. But what I will say is this: the street agents. Okay, all the agents down in the field, the gun-carrying agents, and the agents who are in headquarters, they are going to continue doing their job like they are doing today and like they were doing 5 years ago. They're going to uphold the Constitution of the United States and look at all these federal laws and enforce and investigate federal law that are being committed, you know, violations of this federal law. That's their job. And they're going to follow the lawful orders that are being, you know, passed down to them, you know, till this day. So I have nothing but 100% respect for the agents in the streets. Are 100% of the agents in the streets good people? No, of course not. Just like I said, we're saying before, in any organization, you're going to have certain people who just don't fit. Mm-hmm. We know it. There are agents in Texas who was stealing during search warrants. You had an agent who, you know, committed a shooting in 2020 in Washington, D.C., and he was just arrested for sexual assault. For raping two women. He believed he's a serial rapist. So you have problems just like any other organization. Those are the people that need to be rooted out. And I'm hoping Mr. Patel comes in to, if he gets confirmed, to come in and say, all right, let's listen. This is what I want to do. These are the corrections I want to make. And then he, you know, does it in a knowledgeable, correct way and without doing too much damage to the structure of the FBI. I know a lot of people have said that they want DC just flattened. They want to destroy the entity. That's not the answer. You can't flatten the FBI and then rebuild it to the organization you want it to be. You need to restructure it. So I think there's work to be done, but he can do it.
And as far as other government restructuring, now, one of the things I was listening to one of your podcasts, you're mentioning the Aurora Apartments case, how it was actually being handled by another agency other than the FBI with the almost exactly the same mandate.
HSI?
Yeah. Yeah. What if the restructuring was to pull HSA into the FBI and simplify those sorts of roles as a government efficiency question?
There's a ton of government efficiency that can be done. Right. I mean, you know, whether DOGE really works, you know, I'd love to see it. There's a ton of government efficiency that can be done. I think there is, you know, we have, as I was stating, that HSI is part of another agency. We do double the work. You know, they're doing the same thing we are. Folding them into us, I don't think is the right answer. Folding HSI because they were hired for their mission under Homeland Security, and that's their job. So bringing those agents into the FBI or merging them together to become a new super agency, I think would also be problematic in itself.
Why would that be a problem?
Because there is, first of all, let's just go down to the base. First of all, I think is this. Let's just go down to the base knowledge, okay? FBI has one system, just computer-wise, mm-hmm. okay? HSI has their own computer system, okay? Bringing HSI agents into the FBI system, you know, we have, you'd have to go through, there's a ton of qualifications and training questions, but merging the two, you'd have a new system. The amount of work and the amount of money that would be spent on merging the two agencies, I think, not to mention would take years, mm-hmm. okay? but it would take an extraordinary amount of money. And I think that would be wasteful.
Wasn't that one of the major mandates of the Patriot Act and the post-Homeland Security reforms was supposed to be to get all these government systems to talk to each other and collaborate across systems, right?
I don't think the systems talking to each other, the computer systems, I think it was just talking to each other. So I don't believe that.
That might be worse. So, right? You know what I mean?
You don't speak the same fucking language over there.
Yeah, right.
So, no. I don't, because, you know, the classified system that the FBI is a circle, it is a classified system. Mm-hmm. And listen, I may have access to the classified system, but I don't have a need to know about that case or that case. And I am not authorized to look at that case or look at that case. But if I'm on the FBI net, technically I could look at it. Technically I have, you know, if I look up a certain case, you know, it may be I don't have the need to know. So I'm violating the regulations of my job by looking at a case that I don't have the need to know to.
But that was the cause of 9/11 from an investigatory, like, why did this happen question, was that some agencies knew that this was a problem, mm-hmm. and other agencies didn't. And so the entire reform was pitched on, we're going to get everyone on the same page so that we can intel share across. And in fact, and competition between these organizations is one of the intelligence community reforms that people point to.
I still think it happens to this day. You know, we're further away from 9/11 every single day.
Right.
And I still think, and it goes again back to what I was referring to earlier, is competition for a promotion. You know, people want to be like, they want to have that big star. They want to have, hey, look at what I did.
Right.
We FBI. And, you know, I fought very, very, and I was on a part of a task force called Joint Task Force Vulcan. So I was partnered with DEA, ATF, HSI. It was a great organization, created under AG Barr on the Trump administration. And it was multi-agency, multi-group, and it was phenomenal. We all worked together. Mm-hmm. There was no secrets, and we all shared that was our one mission, was the MS-13 leadership, and it worked fantastic. So it can be done, but that doesn't, you know, like I said, creating a new agency, I don't know what the answer is. I think that there would be so much cost and so much battle of HSI going, I'm not going to partner with that, and FBI going, I'm not going to be working with them. You know, I think that I don't think that that's the answer. I think restructuring the system, and that there be intelligence sharing. There is a lot. The intelligence sharing today is a lot better than obviously it was pre-9/11. It's still great. I mean, it's still a lot better than it was pre-9/11. But there still is the, you know, I got to be better. I got to, you know, jockey position. And then at the same time, you know, I know for a fact that there is the, what are you doing in my territory? This is my thing. You know, I do this, you know, don't be encroaching on my thing. And that there's a lot of battle between agencies where if you're an FBI agent and you're conducting something that may piss off the State Department or may piss off the CIA, then you may be like, well, am I working with you? And then they'd be like, no, don't come in on my territory. So there's still a lot of, you know, this is my fucking neighborhood. Don't come here. So
did you ever run into issues like that with just doing cartel work of there being something, some issue with the State Department or anything like that? Of like,
I did not, because I never had anything that really could, you know, crossed borders, because I was part of that multi-agency task force. Mm-hmm. We worked really well with each other, and a lot of so we had a couple of captures that were in Mexico, you know, and we worked well with Mexican law enforcement to do captures of El Salvadorians in Mexico. So they're illegal immigrants in Mexico, mm-hmm. so that they would get deported to the United States where they're wanted. Mm. So Mexicans weren't arresting them. They were just deporting an illegal immigrant into the San Diego at the border station. And we'd be standing right there like, welcome to America, you're under arrest. Mm. So we were doing that to get them here. I know of cases. I know of cases where there is definitely like, you know, anger from one agency to another. So I personally have never done, but I know of it.
You know, there's a question here from Adam that might be relevant to this, from the Discord. He's asking, how much can the FBI accomplish domestically without the help of local law enforcement? If a county sheriff,
I'll jump in right now and say nothing. And that's complete bullshit. What you see. So I've, you know, I watch TV now, and being an FBI agent is kind of ruined. And I apologize for interrupting, but I can jump on this one right now. I can jump on this one right now. I could jump on this.
We've had a soapbox. Let's go. So,
there is nothing that, you know, the FBI, one of the best partners we have is local law enforcement. So everything you see, all right, so I've watched a lot of TV and the movies, and there have been very, very few TV shows. One of the only ones that I like are good is on the Paramount Network. It's called FBI True. Mm. I think, the FBI True, which you're sitting down with FBI agents and you're hearing about the case. But all those TV shows, everything you see on all those networks of FBI this, Fugitive Man, complete hogwash, complete bullshit. It's fun. It's entertaining for those who aren't. But when I sit there, it drives me absolutely bonkers. I can't do it because they'll sit there and be like, okay, here we go. We got his phone thing, this thing, and that thing. You can't do that. It takes weeks to do that. Right. But to answer your question, you know, we never, ever showed up at a scene and said, FBI here, we're taking over. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Never happened.
So are you going to watch Die Hard for Christmas?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Die Hard's the example of that. Exactly. I think most people go to. Yeah,
yeah. The best Christmas movie out there. And for a fact, I'm saying Die Hard is a Christmas movie.
Yes. So there we go.
I will go on. Here I will go down.
I'm with you.
Along with pineapple and ham on my pizza.
Oh, yes. We got another.
There you go. So everybody in New Jersey is going, fuck you, man.
You're excommunicated.
I lost my jersey. But yes, so we showed up, and like I said, some of my best, I couldn't do, you know, any of my work without local, whether it be other federal agencies that I worked with, more importantly, local. I mean, because they know the neighborhoods, they know the people, they know and they're the ones first. You build a good relationship with the local, they're going to be, hey, and give me a call at 2 a.m. Hey, Dan, I got a guy here. You know, and I can't tell you how many times I got a call at 2 a.m. from Patterson PD. Hey, we got this guy here. You want to talk to him? Yeah, I'll be on my way. And I would come in. You wouldn't get those calls if you didn't have the good relationship with the sergeant, the detectives. I never talked to the lieutenants, captains. I didn't care about that. I wanted to know the detectives, the sergeants, the guys who were on the streets, and they'd be like, hey, this is the latest. Hey, this is a photograph of the newest member. They're not working the case, but they're getting the intelligence for me on my MS-13 cases. Mm-hmm. So I could never, ever do anything without the cooperation of locals, and I loved them.
The second part of Adam's question here is, so he's basically asking, if a county sheriff, especially a Western sheriff, tells them to get out, what can they actually do without them? Like, is that an issue that kind of comes
up
at all?
I can't comment on Western culture out here. I know it's, so a good way to say it is, in New Jersey, I lived in a town called Totowa, New Jersey, and Wayne, New Jersey, two towns I lived in. And if you had, say, we had a shooting, an active shooter at the Garden State Plaza Mall one night. We got the call. It was 11 o'clock at night, you know, I'm part of SWAT, and we were rolling out. By the time we got there, I'm not kidding, you could have no less than 9 different agencies, law enforcement agencies, all there claiming that they're the lead agency. And that's FBI, HSI, and then you can go down the ladder, you know, Division of Criminal Justice and these are all gun carrying agents. DCJ for state of New Jersey, the Attorney General, State Police, the Prosecutor's Office, who has guns, those are the AD. Then you got the Sheriff's Department. Then you have the local PD. So you have a lot of agencies all overlapping in New Jersey. Whereas here in Bozeman, in the city of Bozeman, you have 3. Mm-hmm. Maybe HSI, but it's FBI, Bozeman PD, and the Sheriff's Office. Outside the city limits, you have FBI and Gallatin County.
Right.
You have 2 agencies.
Right.
So they're going to work together. I mean, it behooves both agencies to say, let's all work together. And in Bozeman, in the city of Bozeman, let's all work together. You know, and that's how it really should work. Now, if a sheriff came in and said, go beat feet, that's where you're, as the agent, you never be like, you know, no, I'm in charge here. That's where you turn to your supervisor and say, hey, soup, they just told me to be. You back out, don't create an incident, back out, let the supervisor run it up the chain of command, let the ASAC, you know, either the ASAC calls the sheriff or the SAC calls the sheriff and say, what's the problem? What's our resolution here? We have a federal violation. We're going to investigate it. And then they're going to come in. We're going to conduct the federal investigation. As long as the FBI has jurisdiction, you know, to oversee it, again, probable cause to conduct the investigation. There's nothing the sheriff can do. I mean, it's not their land. It's not their territory. Mm-hmm. Now, reservations, that's different. That's a completely different.
Yeah.
But in the city, in the county of Gallatin, using example where we live, they can't bar the FBI.
Yeah, I think the question comes from a culture established in the West, particularly in the fallout of Ruby Ridge.
Yeah.
and a hostility to the FBI because of that.
Yeah, I felt that here. I've kind of gotten some negative energy from some people here.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on that, like as far as Ruby Ridge and the way it's affected the culture surrounding the FBI?
Well, I think the tragedy at Ruby Ridge was absolutely horrible. I mean, the shooting was unfortunate and it was absolutely, you know, tragedy, loss of life anywhere. I don't care at any level is horrible. I don't ever want a loss of life, you know, unless it's a, you know, school shooter or something like that. And if you want to take your own life, go for it, knock yourself out. And like yesterday in Oroville in California, he shot two kids and took his own life. Good. You know, now we don't have to deal with the trial and but if you're going to do it to yourself, you're going to harm a child. I'm fine with that.
Of course.
But as far as Ruby Ridge, like I said, that was an unfortunate situation. That was tragedy that it happened. From what I know about Ruby Ridge, I know a lot more about Waco and Oklahoma City because of my domestic terrorism days. The Ruby Ridge situation, listen, if you're violating federal law, if you're in violation of federal law, and that can be proved, hey, listen, you want to argue that, go for it. But that's you're supposed to argue it in court.
Right.
You're supposed to argue in court. And that's why they say, I mean, it's the same way we're talking about today. If there's a vehicle stop, don't argue with the cop on the scene. Just, okay, there we go. Give him your driver's license. If he arrests you and it's, you know, he doesn't have probable cause, there's a camera being recorded right there on his body cam. And then you go to court and take him out.
Yeah.
You prove that your civil rights were violated.
Well, that's that but-for question, right? So in the case of this, it's Randy Weaver was asked by an FBI informant,
right,
who was taking money on behalf of the FBI,
mm-hmm,
to saw off a shotgun and make it illegal.
Yeah.
Right. And so then he did. And that was their probable cause to then go do everything and all the tragedy that unfolded from that.
Right.
So your kind of case, if I'm understanding right, is that Randy Weaver should have, you know, after he was charged, basically I wouldn't have done this if it weren't for that.
Correct. Let his lawyer argue.
But there's a confidence in the legal system there that a lot of people suffer a sense
100%. And then there's a lot of people out there who are going to say, well, I don't believe in the court system. I don't believe in the legal system. You know, I've been screwed over. I agree. Yeah. But it's just, I'm going through the same things. And it's obviously, it was a different time in the 90s for Ruby Ridge. It's a different environment. There's a lot more stricter rules today at the FBI because they learned from their mistakes at Ruby Ridge when HRT moved in, and the sniper and taking the shot and, you know, the deadly force authorization. So there's a lot more strict requirements put on FBI agents when conducting operations like that, so that doesn't happen again.
But is there an argument for reform of the process, right, where FBI agents aren't fishing for someone to find somebody to saw off a shotgun, but rather are, you know what I mean?
No,
like,
no,
I don't even understand.
I agree.
Why someone is asking for that? Or does that make sense? What is the motive there other than careerism, other than I was able to bust a guy, so I found a guy? And also the perverse economic incentive of I'm paying you $50,000 to find me a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
And so you generate a criminal, you make one.
Correct. Right? Yeah. Right. And that's why you never, but here's the thing is I could pay you, I never paid $50,000 for an informant, but no, I know what you're saying.
Just throwing out a number.
Right. Yeah. So if I gave, I never paid an informant money in advance. So, hey, find me a criminal. Give me your intelligence. Let me find out if it pans out. Mm-hmm. That's when I gave him compensation. And it may not always been money. It may have been, you know, compensation for, you know, staying in the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had, you know, immigration issues because a lot of times in my MS-13 cases.
Right.
So I never paid in advance because of that exact reason of, you know, you never know what you're getting. And I don't want to, you know, give him, you know, so I had informants, which were, you know, I would hold over them the, you know, the deportation clause.
Mm-hmm.
They would be allowed to stay in this country as long as they provided information. And once that information was vetted, that would just reinvigorate, hey, okay, I will justify, this justifies you keeping it. But if you keep giving me crap, then I could shut it down immediately and I could have you deported right away.
And there's a really good institutionalist case for that too, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're saying we're diverting resources from finding actual criminals at large,
mm-hmm,
to generating criminals at that point and making someone into, if not the but for, right? You're rather than agents spending their time going after Randy Weaver, they could have been prosecuting drug cartels, or there's a misallocation of resources argument at a minimum in that case.
Well, listen, there, you can have an argument for everything. I mean, that's fine. You can have a debate over that. But, you know, I use the argument of, well, you know, why are you busting me? You should be busting this type of criminal. Listen, right. There's agents who are, that's what their job is. Their job is to investigate federal violations of gun violations. Uh-huh. I am not familiar with the intricacies of the Randy Weaver situation. All I know is what I've seen in documentaries.
Sure.
And I think it's a tragedy. As far as the, you know, he had an informant sawing off, I'm taking your word for it. I, you know, like I said, I'm not completely familiar with it, so I can't speak from a position.
And I'm not an expert either. I'm just my recollection.
I'm
is
not
that's
speaking
the story,
from but, a position of an FBI case agent of sure. like, yeah, if those were the situations, if that was the situation where he, you know, the FBI agent said, hey, you know, I need a shotgun. Can you saw it off? And you're Randy Weaver. Can you saw it off for me? Okay, you just committed a violation because I'm asking if it, but for. You know, if it hadn't been for me, you wouldn't have sawed off that shotgun. You wouldn't have violated. So that's the but-for rule. Mm-hmm. Now him, you know, he arguing and, you know, just, you know, not agreeing. And yeah, again, like I said, that's the but-for rule, the entrapment rule. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, that's for me, that would be based on this conversation. That would be somewhat of an entrapment. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't be kosher with it as an agent. I would never have done that.
Sure.
That's why I would never pay an informant in advance. And I would never say, it's just, I want information. I want intelligence. I would never have an informant, excuse me. I don't believe I ever had an informant say, go out there and find something for me. I was the one out there finding. Right. Just tell me what's going on in the streets. I'll go talk to the restaurant owners. I'll go talk to the people in the streets. And I'd be hearing, okay, these guys may be doing this. These guys may be doing this. Okay, let's investigate that.
Right. And obviously what we're looking at here is a minority of total FBI cases. We're looking at the exceptions possibly to the general
Correct.
Rule, and you're saying is that, you know, 90% are all doing the right thing.
Yes.
And there's a certain set of agents that maybe
are
entrapping. There
are thousands of cases that never get talked about in the
right.
FBI.
Right.
Thousands, tens of thousands that we never talk about. And that's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
We shouldn't talk about any of them other than, hey, Senator Bob Menendez was finally indicted and finally, you know, found guilty of all these charges. Thank God he's gone.
Yeah.
You know, good. So, but, you know, unfortunately, you don't get judged on your wins, you get judged on your losses. And Ruby Ridge was an unfortunate, tragic incident. And yes, I'm sure that we could sit here and your viewers at home could sit here and we'll talk about this case. What about this case? What about this case? What about this case? And they all matter to those viewers. Mm-hmm. Each one of those cases matter to them individually. And that's great. But you can't look at the entirety of the FBI based on that one case or that one thing. You know, convicting 35,000 employees of the FBI because of one bad incident or one bad is wrong.
Yeah. Well, just switching subjects just slightly, yep. Something that I think matters to everybody is data privacy. And mm-hmm. obviously we've had this major hack recently. Is that something that you've been looking into at all?
Yeah, I've been reading about the Chinese hack of the phone systems. Yeah.
It's not something I've seen talked about very widely in the media. What can you kind of lay it out for us, like what you know of it so far?
So from what I understand is there are hackers in China that work for the Chinese government that have hacked the U.S. phone systems of Verizon and I believe two other major carriers.
I think it was AT&T was involved.
Yeah. And they've gotten so deep into the system that they even got into the system that the law enforcement utilizes to conduct wiretaps. So law enforcement, you know, so we, you know, the traditional ways of where you see the reel-to-reel tape, and that's not how wiretaps work. Wiretaps work with cooperation with, you know, the phone company. We work with the phone company, the law enforcement branch. We give them the search warrant, the Title III warrant, and they have all this. And then they do their wire systems, and that gets routed into the building where the monitoring team will be. And then the rules that are very, very strict of, you know, of minimizing and can't listen to every conversation. But that's conducted at the building level. But it's the phone company that facilitates that based on the court orders. Now, from what I understand, the Chinese have gotten into the systems, not only of that wiretapping system, but to all everybody's phones so that they could literally see all our text messages, all our voice messages, all our everything, all our data on our phones. And
like everybody on Verizon or AT&T or
that's
whatever.
How I understood it. Yeah. Wow. And now I've heard that they've, I don't feel the confidence coming out when I see these reports that they've been able to get most of the Chinese hack out. I don't feel confident with that.
Most of it?
Right. And that, again, it goes with the 50% rule. Is like, you know, they're saying, oh, yeah, we got most of it out.
It's like, yeah, we got most of your cancer removed, but it should be
out. We got most of your bone, broken bone fixed. We got most of it fixed. Okay. So I am not feeling confident that that's actually, you know, been done.
So that lies, there's the danger
is, you know, when you have systems like WhatsApp, Signal, Telegram, those are end-to-end encryption, which means you transmit it to me. FBI can't listen to it. No law enforcement agency can jump in the middle and listen or read your conversations. You know, it's written by you, it's sent, it's all encrypted, and it's decrypted on your device. But if they're getting access to your device, they can see your entire conversation.
So they have the encryption key at that point? Is that what you're saying?
No, they're just seeing what you're seeing.
Oh, they're just seeing it on the screen.
But like, they can tap into the ends. Like, the protection of the end-to-end encryption protects the transmission of the text.
Correct.
But if they can just see the end of it, then it doesn't matter.
Which I've done, which they're doing in New York City right now, is to try and look at this phone. Right. And I've done that. I've done search warrants on people's phones and looked at the phone. And then when we're able to get into that, once we get the search warrant and, you know, I'm able to get into the phone, I can look at all items on the phone. I can look at everything. And if I open up WhatsApp, I'm looking at an entire conversation back and forth, unless they've deleted the conversation. Let's say they deleted it.
If you're using like disappearing text messages on Signal, do those get scrubbed?
I believe so. I believe from what I understand there, that's kind of like what that what were the kids using these days?
Snapchat.
Fuck it.
Snapchat.
I can't believe you just said kids these days. Kids these days.
Them and their Snapchatting.
I had a situation yesterday where I was laughing with my wife and I couldn't believe I said. So there was a guy driving around town here on a motorcycle last night, and he was just boom, 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 boom on his crotch rocket everywhere around town. I mean, he was all over town, running up and down Huffine, running up and down Jackrabbit. But on his backpack, he had a backpack that was all lit up. So it had different signs, like lick my balls. There was a little bunny rabbit. And he was just, and I saw him at 19th and Huffine, right? And that was where at the intersection where he went right by me in my truck. 10 minutes later, my wife saw him at the Target, which is on the other side of town. And she was texting me. She's like, oh my God, I just saw him again. And I was like, oh, you know, maybe someone should call the cops. And I went, oh my God, I just became an old man. Kids these days.
No, motorcycles.
Dang loud motorcycles.
So on the data breach question, it seemed to me the most likely outcome, it'd be strange that Verizon has access to the internal workings of your individual phone, because they're the network carrier, right? It seems like to me China would most likely have the data that was sent over the network at the time of transmission that they had access to this data, not everything on your phone.
No, I believe that. Right? Listen,
if it is on your phone,
you're talking to the wrong person here. You should talk to FBI CART people.
Yeah.
But if you're connected to their network, to the Verizon network, there's no reason why Verizon can't get into your phone.
Yeah, if they install a keylogger or an application on your phone that does that, right? Because usually the phone operating system
and
itself
how do we know that the Chinese haven't done that?
A mass keylogging would be a very interesting story, right? Because what that would mean is that there was an operating system update that included this or something like that you would do over the carrier network. That's often always carried by the technology servicer themselves, like Apple or Google or whatever.
Well, here's something what you said earlier really dawned on me. It's like, I do not do TikTok. Absolutely not. Do not do that. Do not put that on my phone, because I've talked to other FBI agents who are very much in the know. When you put TikTok on your phone, you're clicking the yes agreements. They have full access to your phone, full access, everything, which means the Chinese government has full access to your phone. Now, the argument is, you know, a lot of kids, he says, I'm 18 years old. You know, what do I need? Chinese, I don't care. They can look at my phone. Well, that's fine. You may not have a problem, but what they have is all your Wi-Fi passwords. And your Wi-Fi passwords, if you're at home and your dad is part of the FBI or something like that along those lines, they have your Wi-Fi passwords. They have access to your Wi-Fi. If they have access to your Wi-Fi, they have access to your dad's phone. So it's a whole network, and they know how to manipulate the algorithms. Was that? They have the algorithm that they're going to push, just like you see when you go on the internet, you go on Amazon, you Google search one thing, then you see all those ads. That's an algorithm being pushed to you. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, TikTok does that from the Chinese government. They have certain, if you look at the TikToks that are in China versus the TikTok feeds in the United States, they're completely different. They're completely different. This is to feed what the Americans want. And in China, it's a lot about educational. So it's a completely different.
They have they have a STEM thing on TikTok America now too. They added that as an option because of the criticism.
They had to do it. They're like, oh, crap, they're on this.
It's like any other company. They have criticism, so they change their direction.
Yeah, that's right.
And TikTok's argument, and I'm just sitting this, it's at the other side of it. I mean, depending on, you know, how people are conceptualizing TikTok America versus TikTok, you know, the Taiwanese and Chinese variations of it. TikTok America is owned predominantly by American investors. There was a, I forget, we covered it. It was like a $10 billion investment along with Cisco Systems, if I remember right, Cisco and Microsoft, to home all of the servers here in the United States.
Listen,
now, if there's back doors built in, that's possible.
That's exactly
what the NSA exists to do, would be to prevent that and to monitor that traffic in order to prevent that kind of espionage.
Listen,
because that risk is also there for Microsoft or I'm not willing to
put my or my kids in the we should be okay.
Oh no,
category. I do not believe TikTok is safe.
Got most of it.
I have good, you know, like I said, good agents that I've worked with and who are, you know, former supervisors of mine that are were head of, like, you know, intelligence agencies in DC, and they're, you know, CCP is the one of the biggest dangers, and the fact that they would just hand over TikTok America without leaving it, you know, a back door for them to get in, I wouldn't trust that.
It was also the profit motive, right? They had a profit motive to do that. So they're going to get literally sold and banned in the United States, right?
Yeah,
so they did it in response to actual government pressure. There's a clear motive. There's material evidence there. But, you know, you never know. I mean, espionage is real. I mean, we cover it all the time. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to lie to the public and then do the opposite.
Yep.
So they might be.
Speaking of espionage in China and New Jersey, where you're from, we've got UAPs all over the place in Jersey.
I saw that.
What's going on, man?
So you know what? That's a good question. I was just watching that this morning, and a good friend of mine, Holly, she's out in California. She, you know, worked for the FBI, and she did a lot of UAP work, and she reposted this, and I saw the article yesterday. It is crazy that they're talking about, they're like the size, people are talking about that they're like 6 foot, like the size of 6 feet, like UAVs and something. So I would love to know, I mean, is there a UAV that hovers that at, you know, that's that size? So I am, you know, it's surprising. In you know, like a lot of people are talking about it. They see it, and they've been flying over military installations, airports, you know, and private locations, energy, power grid stations.
How can they be allowed to fly over all this like sensitive infrastructure, military bases and stuff, and not be taken down?
Taken by who?
I mean, exactly. I don't know.
That's exactly.
I guess we don't know whose they are.
Who's they? First of all, we don't know whose they are. Right. The UAVs. The UAPs, but who is also, that's a good question that we have to have in this country is who is they taking them down? Is that a federal thing? Is there an agency that drives around with anti, you know, air type of thing? Or do you give that to the local? Because obviously the response time, if you were to, let's say we were to have an agency, let's say, you know, independent part of the FAA. You'd have five
Space
agencies.
Space Force.
Let's go. We have Space Force. Five of them in every state. You know, they're covering the entire state. Or how many? Okay, you're going to have 20, 30 guys. You know, they're all carrying in their trunk, you know, anti-UAV. Or what if they accidentally shoot down a UAV that is belonging to just some guy who's, you know, at home flying it?
Well, if you're flying it over a military installation, right. You get what's coming to you, right?
Exactly. That's what you're hoping for. So I don't know. That's a good question. Why? I don't know if the anti. So I wrote an article not too long ago about the anti-drone warfare type equipment that is being utilized in Ukraine right now. And I think Ukraine is like a great example. The battle in the war in Ukraine is a great example. And it's advancing UAV warfare exponentially because not only anti-drones devices, but also drone warfare, showing, you know, what one tiny UAV that's like 1 foot by 1 foot can do to the mentality of a troop line. I mean, just hearing that buzz is freaking out, and rightfully so, because some of them have grenades, some of them have flamethrowers, some of them have, you know, Magna, all kinds of shit on them. So yeah, it freaks him up because boom, and it blows up. Mm-hmm. So even if it's just flying, just a regular, you know, flying around, they're the columns are breaking up because their fear that that thing is actually a drone with a bomb on it. So it's completely distorting warfare.
Yeah.
But that's a great question as to, you know, who's going to have the anti-drone device.
Yeah. Do you think that they are like man-made conventional drones, maybe military equipment, or are you open to the idea that they're not from from Earth?
From Earth. No, I think that they're US because if you look at the videos that you see the red green from port and starboard lights. Mm-hmm. So, and that is traditionally a US, it's, you know, aircraft have red right, green left. So yes, so you have green and left lights. So you see that. Okay, so these are...
On some of them, yeah.
On some of them, not all of them.
Yeah.
So I think that this is all New Jersey, but you're seeing the red, green. So that's a large aircraft that is being flown.
Well, and if it is the feds, if it's our government flying them, the question, what is the motive to mysteriously flying around a bunch of drones?
It's not U.S. feds, because if it was feds, we wouldn't be doing it over New Jersey. Okay. Yeah. Because listen, there's fucking 9 million people in New Jersey. They're gonna see it.
Yeah, well, exactly. There's no expectation of this being secret.
Correct.
If you're flying
it ain't the feds. If the feds wanted to keep this secret, they'd be flying it over Nevada. If they were testing aircraft, it'd be in Nevada, over the desert, in Arizona, in Area 51 or wherever that you know, you got those fucking places out there. But
whoever it is, they obviously want it to be seen because they have lights all over them. Like if they wanted it to be stealth, they would be dark, right?
I think this goes back to a lot of people. Listen, you got the internet these days. So you got a guy who's like flying his shit around and he wants this to get attention. He's getting hits. Oh, look at this. I don't know. I definitely don't know enough about it. The fact that they're saying that these are 6 feet large, like the size of cars.
Yeah.
I've never heard of a UAV that hovers. I know the UAVs that fly. Mm-hmm. For U.S. military that are
drones.
Predator drones. Thank you.
Yep.
They're predator drones, but I've never heard of one that's the size of a car that is like your traditional four propeller.
Right.
You know,
and can do that for hours and hours and hours. Yeah. Like the length of time is also suspect because that implies battery technology, weight ratio technologies that we currently consumers don't typically have.
Right.
So that either indicates a foreign government, our government. Or something beyond, whatever.
I think it personally, like I said, knowing New Jersey and having lived there 20 years, I think it's, whether kids or adults that are just causing havoc and creating something to have this conversation.
Sure.
Is it an alien or is it the government? No, I don't think it's the government because it's too obvious. Mm-hmm. You know, the government's not going to be flying in a UAV with red, green.
Reverse psychology.
There you go. Why I came on here.
That was great.
Yeah.
Good time. Thanks,
absolutely.
Guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us, man.
Thank
it's been
you
a
for
great conversation.
I appreciate it.
I hope we can have you back again sometime.
I live 10 minutes away, so it's my pleasure at any time.
Yeah.
And
where can people find your stuff?
Thank you. So I'm on my social media, presence is very small for that reason because I like my clients. I don't advertise much, but I'm on LinkedIn. People can look me up. I'm on Substack also. It's BrunerSierraGroup.substack.com. So I put out a newsletter about once or twice a week on the latest in threats, latest in dangers, latest different things that are going on. So if you're interested in subscribing, please, it's a free subscription. I don't charge on the Substack. I'm not looking to make money. I just want everybody to be informed.
Beautiful. Thanks again, Dan.
Thank you.
And thanks for watching. We'll see you in the next one.
Peace.
Peace.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com. And remember.
And then 4 years were domestic terrorism going after skinheads, white supremacists. And then...
Oh, David.
Uh-oh. Hey, he's bald too.
Exactly. We fit in. We'll fit in.
Some
we'll
of it's a choice. Some of it's genetics. All right.